crazy times. I think it's cool. We've got some more private companies, like name brand private companies, buying Bitcoin. Michael Saylor and some of the big miners aren't the only one.
GameStop is almost now becoming like a Bitcoin hedge fund itself. So we went from this crazy thing where GME was going to blow up a hedge fund. Now they've got all this cash and they're going to buy Bitcoin with it, become like a Bitcoin hedge fund.
You start with one and then very quickly find yourself with like seven. And you wonder like why your electricity bill is so high, but you don't care, you know, because, you know, solo mining, all it takes is to hit it one time. And then all of these bills, you know, are like nothing burgers.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Bitcoin Banter. I have Rick and Tony with me. Gentlemen, let's jump right into the news. So this week, GameStop has announced a Bitcoin strategy. I think a lot of people saw it coming. Let's watch this video real quick.
Hey Charles, thanks for coming back on. Listen, as to their almost $5 billion they have in cash, again, no debt by the way, we think they should put at least half of that amount, at least $2.5 billion should go into Bitcoin at this point. The problem that Ryan Cohen, excellent CEO, has is that he should have made these moves a year or 2 years ago when Bitcoin was 30, 40,
yeah, yeah,
$50,000.
But that's what if, right? That doesn't matter anymore, right? That's in the past. But for the future, you say this is a good approach, though.
Absolutely. It's a great special situation stock. We played AMC. We did well there. We used Trump Media, did well there. We think GameStop is going to 50 on this move. Ultimately $100, because this is now a $13 billion hedge fund that's got the ability to invest in Bitcoin, which is just getting started, is the best supply demand story there is. We applaud Ryan Cohen on this excellent move.
All righty. So one of their investors thinks they should use half of their cash to buy more Bitcoin. What they've done so far, though, is they've opened up this as an option to purchase Bitcoin, and they've issued I think maybe today it's going to become available, like 1.3 billion in debt that yields nothing to the creditor, and they're going to buy some Bitcoin. So crazy times. I think it's cool. We've got some more private companies, like name brand private companies, buying Bitcoin. Michael Saylor and some of the big miners aren't the only one. Rick, I'll let you take this one first. What is your initial reaction to GameStop and to all the mania going around right now?
Sure. My main question is, what does GameStop do? Right? Like in my mind, GameStop is kind of like Blockbuster, right? Like you go in and you rent games from them, or you buy consoles or something. It seems like this really like antiquated business. Maybe I'm not doing it justice. We don't have GameStop over here, right? So I don't fully understand their business model. But as I understand it, you know, they're kind of like a struggling business. Then this Ryan Cohen guy bought it for like pennies on the dollar or something. And then what I do remember, the thing that's funny to me about this is, do you remember the GME short squeeze thing? I can't remember. Was this like a year ago or something? And basically, like a bunch of degens on Reddit had figured out that like there was some hedge fund with a naked short sales on the GME stock, right? So everyone started buying it, trying to blow up this hedge fund. And they got pretty close to like completely wiping out this giant hedge fund. But then there was all that crazy carry on with like Robinhood getting rid of the buy button in the app and all this sort of stuff to try and defend this hedge fund. So it's quite funny for me. It's almost ironic, right? That GameStop is almost now becoming like a Bitcoin hedge fund itself. So we went from this crazy thing where GME was going to blow up a hedge fund. Now they've got all this cash and they're going to buy Bitcoin with it, become like a Bitcoin hedge fund. It's all quite mad, and I have no idea like what they do. And it's just the typical craziness, right? The degeneracy continues because they launched this news. A bunch of degens like, yeah, go GameStop, right? They go in, they buy a load of GameStop shares. And then I think like within 24 hours, the stock price is down by 25%, right? So this is what you get. These are the prizes you win if you get influenced by like short-term news. Someone else is going to buy Bitcoin. This person is going to buy Bitcoin. Well, listen, if you're so bullish on Bitcoin, then why just buy the Bitcoin? I really struggle with this, right? I really struggle with this. Like people buy a MicroStrategy stock because MicroStrategy is buying a load of Bitcoin, or buying GME stock or Semla and all the others, when you can actually buy the thing that's making these companies valuable in their own right. So look, no shade at Ryan Cohen, right? If you made me the CEO of GME tomorrow, guess what I'm doing? I'm taking that 4.6 billion of cash and I'm slamming it straight in Bitcoin, just like this guy would. But the bit I don't understand is why everyone now wants to buy GME stock. Like the guy in the video, oh, it's going to $100, it's going to this. And maybe you'll outpace the growth of Bitcoin with some of these speculative stocks, right? Because a load of other crazy people buy in and use leverage and all this. But man, you're playing some crazy risky games. We've already seen it. You're 25% down already, right? Like you should have just bought the Bitcoin. So play stupid games, win stupid prizes. But Ryan Cohen is making the same decision I would make. So this will continue, by the way, right? Like every individual has these incentives. They should buy Bitcoin. Every company should buy Bitcoin. Every government should buy Bitcoin. But none of these people should buy GME stock. Like this isn't complicated. Just buy the Bitcoin.
Yeah, I completely agree. I really don't understand. I mean, unless your thesis on this is the all of the counterparty risk that you're taking on buying GameStop, or you know when they issue debt, you know buying the debt, is that you're going to outperform massively. Like you're going to 10x what Bitcoin does, and that delta is enough to justify the risk you're taking on. Okay, because you're also going to be slapped with 20% capital gains taxes, or even higher potentially short-term capital gains. And maybe you come out well ahead of Bitcoin and you use that to buy Bitcoin. It's a lot of hoops to jump through, a ton of risk to take on. Now, if you've got like a retirement, you know, account or something like that, where you can't buy Bitcoin directly, to me, I still feel like even the ETFs seem like a better option there, because you're really only taking on one counterparty risk, you know, with the custodian. But you still have all the regulatory risk. You still have all of that. I understand some people are pigeonholed, though, in certain aspects of their financial lives. But aside from that, I couldn't agree with you more. Tony, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say you're probably not buying GameStop stock.
Absolutely not, man. But I understand why it's so confusing to both of you. I mean, it's very clear to me why people buy these stocks. It's because nobody understands Bitcoin. You know, because if you did, why would you bother with, you know, all of these hoops that you just described, whether it's the taxes or the regulatory compliance or the risks or what have you? Just buy the asset directly, because that's the very thing that's giving these zombie companies any value, right? So why are you using them as a proxy? Go straight to the product itself, take it, create your own strategic reserve, and live happily ever after. But it's just, you know, reconfirms that these people just act on what they understand, which is TradFi. They have no idea what Bitcoin is. You know, they haven't spent 5 minutes doing their research. They're just going for the path of least resistance. And so if they see, you know, 4.3 billion going into Bitcoin, all they see is that potential 100x or whatever crazy number that's in their head. And they just, you know, hope for the best. But like you said, it's down 25%. So it would have been less risky to just hold the asset, you know, in self-custody and not worry about any of that unnecessary anxiety. My concern is this is going to become a trend for all of these companies. Like what a company is supposed to offer value into this world, right? Like what are they offering? Like what's their product? Whether it's MicroStrategy, whether it's, you know, GameStop. I mean, kudos to them for increasing their value. I mean, there's no full respect on that. But if you think about it, like a company, you know, you're supposed to provide either a product or a service to benefit someone, right? What is that? And is this like sort of like a glitch in the matrix now that every unproductive company just, you know, found this like thing, just go buy Bitcoin, and now all of a sudden we become valuable, you know, entities in the world? Like how long will this going to last? You know, like, I mean, I don't know. Like all of this for me, it's like, it's just incomprehensible. I mean, you believe in Bitcoin, just buy it yourself, hold it in self-custody, and don't worry about any of these other things.
Maybe if I could play devil's advocate for a minute, maybe what So I think we all kind of agree on our opinion of like Bitcoin banks, like just self-custody your Bitcoin, don't take on counterparty risk. But I view it as a, with high probability that we live in a world 10, 20 years from now where Bitcoin banks are real. And so maybe the case you could make is what you're doing is you're investing in, like if it's MicroStrategy, if it's GameStop, someday these are going to be like two of the massive, they're going to be the JP Morgan, you know, of Bitcoin banks. And so you're playing the long game that someday when people want financial services, more traditional financial services built on top of Bitcoin, you're getting in at the ground floor of the companies who are going to have accumulated enough Bitcoin to do something like that in a meaningful way. Obviously I still don't value the, you know, I don't want to support legacy, you know, finance, you know, on top of Bitcoin. It's not a risk I would want to take. I just want to live a peaceful life. But maybe that's the case you could make is if you're in this for the long haul, you know, MicroStrategy is pretty likely to be a very powerful company 20 years from now with, you know, all the Bitcoin they hold. I don't know. Thoughts on that?
I think you're being quite generous, Michael, right? I know some characters that are a bit degenerate that will have slammed some money into this GME. And I promise you, they've not got some well thought out thesis about GME becoming like the service provider to a brand new Bitcoin economy. They're just like, GME, where can I buy it? Slam it in. It's going to the moon, right? Like, and also, you know, it's an interesting premise you bring up that just because they bought a load of Bitcoin does not mean that they're going to be any good at providing any Bitcoin related services to people in the future. So if that was your thesis, I'd suggest, man, you're really like grasping at some straws. And again, like we've said, you're jumping through all these crazy hoops, coming up with all these fantasies of what might happen to try and outperform Bitcoin. That's insane. For the last 5 years, Bitcoin has performed at like a compound annual growth rate of 50%. If that's not good enough for you, then you're greedy. You're too greedy. And that greed is going to come back and bite you in the ass. I guarantee it.
Well said. All right. It's, yeah, maybe I think very long term, like, you know, maybe you get on the right horse for, you know, 20 years or whatever, but I suspect you're probably right. Just a lot of people on Reddit just hitting that buy button. All right, let's jump into the next bit of news. Speaking of institutional adoption and Michael Saylor. So he says he's going to burn his Bitcoin after he dies and is going to leave an economic a legacy of economic immortality. So this is an interesting concept. Tony, I'll let you take this one first. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on, you know, whether you view this as a, like a generous gesture or, you know, I don't know, someone with kids, you know, how you view, you know, the notion of burning your Bitcoin when you die.
Yeah, but this was a very powerful statement. When I heard it, you know, I was a little taken aback because it's very selfless. You know, if I understand, I don't think he has kids, right? And if that's the case, I mean, what's the best way to leave an impactful, you know, legacy after you go is, you know, to donate all that Bitcoin that he's accumulated. And it's a really significant amount to the community. It merits, you know, like the highest levels of respect as far as I'm concerned. You know, like even if you have kids, you know, and if your kids haven't done the work and understand the sacrifices that you have done as a Bitcoiner to accumulate whatever it is that you have and secure it, you know, to endure the test of time, the volatility, the attacks and all of that. And if you end up with kids that are just flippant about this and just, you know, are taking it for granted. As a parent, I know I would rather donate it to the community than give it to someone who doesn't deserve it, even if it's my own kids. You know, that's my view on these things. Because it's so hard to get through the Bitcoin transition, and there's a lot of, you know, proof of work on the individual to do, someone to just take it because it's like a given to them, I don't agree with that. You know, you want that Bitcoin, you have to prove it. You have to show me your proof of work that you merit all the sacrifices that I've done as a parent to make sure it's around for you when you're old enough to benefit from it.
Yeah. Rick, what's your take on this?
I've probably spent a lot too much time thinking about this, right? Because it is fascinating, right? Like, it's a really interesting strategy. And to start, I think, you know, it's not a new idea, right? This isn't a new idea. Like, it's long been considered a donation to the network if you lose the keys to your Bitcoin, or you send it to an address that gets burned, right? And the logic's simple. There's less Bitcoin in supply after you lose some, so everybody else's is worth a little bit more, right? And weirdly, over the years, you see quite a lot of people like burning Bitcoin, or supposedly burning Bitcoin, by sending it to like Satoshi's old addresses, right? And calling it a donation to the network. I mean, that's based on the assumption that Satoshi will never move that Bitcoin, but you know, it's been a good few years, right? So we've got a relative amount of confidence in that. But what I do, there are things I find weird about it the more I think about it, right? So like, first of all, like Michael Saylor, I think, has been fairly open recently about things like Bitcoin banks, or, you know, maybe using your collateral, your Bitcoin as collateral for loans and things like this. But here's the kicker, right? You would only be able to do this strategy if you're in self-custody. Think about it. Because if my Bitcoin's at an exchange, or, you know, in some other arrangement where I'm not holding the keys and control the Bitcoin myself, then, you know, if I die and my Bitcoin's in Coinbase, it's not been burned. You know, and let's say I have no heirs to inherit that Bitcoin. To be honest, I'm not 100% sure what happens. I'm sure there's some rules around this, because even in banking, right, someone might die with a load of money in their bank account. So I don't know what happens in that situation. But I think it's quite telling, right? Because it kind of tells me quite clearly that if that's Michael Saylor's plans, then his personal Bitcoin must be in self-custody. I don't see any other way that he could achieve that otherwise. And maybe he's got some legal agreements to that effect. I don't know. But I think he's in self-custody. And I find that strange when you know, they promote so much this idea that Bitcoin should be, you know, locked up with custodians and used for different financial rails. The other thing that I find quite strange about it is, you know, I've reached this point with Bitcoin where I just see it as money, right? And money as a form of capital. So I find it strange that the thing that he thinks he can do the most positive impact with is just burning it. Because, you know, you're supposed to like deploy capital, you know, to further innovation, to make humans take the next step. Like, let's take Elon Musk, for example, right? Whether you agree with him or not, he's got all this money. And he's got this moonshot of a project, which is, I want to try and get everybody to Mars. Now, that might help humanity. It might not help humanity. Who knows, right? But what he's doing is he's deploying capital to try and, you know, shape a world in the future that he thinks everybody will be better off in. Well, with Michael's plan, if he burns all the Bitcoin, it is a donation to everybody on the network. But, you know, there's no guarantee that these people on the network are going to use that Bitcoin for anything good or anything particularly productive. For all Michael knows, that, you know, they'll go and spend it on fizzy drinks and burgers and shoes and drugs and God knows what, right? So there's something in it. There's something in it that I just can't wrap my head around. It almost feels like a lack of ambition, right? Or maybe a lack of creativity of how could I take this huge amount? If he really doesn't care about the money and he doesn't care about the return, could he go and build 2,000 wells in Africa and do it because, okay, it doesn't make commercial sense. It's not going to pay a return, but I'm going to die. I want to give it away. So I'm going to just build infrastructure projects just as an idea. And it's kind of, I tell you where I'm at with it, right? I think there's a lot of sort of narratives in Bitcoin now where it's just a method to get rich. You buy it, you hold it, and you don't do anything else with it. And then when you die, you just burn it. And I'm like, guys, this is money. You're meant to use it. It's like money is like a lubricant to allow you to achieve things. Money is not the end goal. It's a means to an end. So strange. It's not the approach I would take. I mean, hell, why not make some donations to the Samurai Defense Fund? Why not make some donations to all sorts of worthy causes, right? So interesting. I'm not going to say it's not generous. I suppose it is. But yeah, interesting. But yeah, if you want to do a Michael Saylor strategy, then you'll have to self-custody your Bitcoin.
Yeah, and to be clear to everyone listening, I don't see any way that this includes the 500,000 or so Bitcoin that MicroStrategy holds, because he doesn't own those. And to your point, I think he needs to be in self-custody for this to even be possible, which would probably make him something of a paranoid crypto anarchist.
Could be.
I don't know. But yeah, I think I share the sentiment. I mean, I've got three kids. I don't know how I think about if I have a kid who's, sort of a prodigal son situation or something like that. I don't anticipate or plan on raising kids like that. And so my hope is when my time comes, I have a family and I have a legacy within my family. Because I'm not just building for Bitcoin. I'm also building a family, and I'm building a life that extends beyond anything that money does or can do. And so my intention is not to burn my Bitcoin, but to raise adults worthy of inheriting that Bitcoin and putting it to good use. And I think the analogy with Elon Musk is a good one, Rick. But yeah, I agree. I'm not going to say it's not generous. To some degree, it will be a gift to the whole world, because hopefully by the time he's gone, we're something close to a Bitcoin standard, and everyone does get to benefit from that in some meaningful way. But I guess time will tell. We'll see.
The thing is, everybody's going to do what they think is the right decision, right? I mean, if you think back to Satoshi Nakamoto, he did his part, and then him too, he just let it go into the wild.
Mm-hmm.
To see, yeah. He said, now it's in good hands. So it could be viewed as a similar approach. You keep in mind, when you get to a certain age, you're not necessarily thinking about entrepreneurship or, going on these massive, life-changing adventures. You just want to know that you've done your part and you've left a good legacy in good hands. So I view his take on this, along those lines. It's not to say there's no right or wrong answer here. It's just, how everybody interprets, how they want to leave this world, right? So, yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree. Alrighty, up next, we've got, we won't linger on this long, but another solo miner found a block. This guy, so I'll read a paragraph of his story. You can imagine how this feels, but he was running, what'd you say, Rick? It was something like 80 terahash,
somewhere on there, yeah. Not small, if a Bitax is going to, a gamma will give you one, right? That gives you some sort of sense of scale. This is not, it's not a mining farm, right? But it's a lot more serious than most people's little hobby kits, certainly.
I wonder how long you've been doing this. So he says, fingers trembling, I launched the Blue Wallet app on my trusty iPhone. The moment it refreshed, a wave of euphoria hit. I couldn't hold it in. We found a block. We found a block, I yelled, my voice echoing through the house. I bolted from bed, racing downstairs to my computer where the CK pool screen glowed like a beacon. There, in bold, beautiful letters, were the words, block accepted. A grin spread across my face. Victory was mine, and it felt incredible. So this is a glimpse into what it's like to solo mine and win the lottery. This is something we've been talking a lot about. Again, we don't need to linger on it, but actually, Rick, I'll let you go first, because I'd love to hear your what you think your reaction would be to this moment.
Oh, man. It'd be crazy. It's a good job I don't live in America, right? Because I'd be driving my truck down the highway, just firing off guns out the window like a lunatic, right? just to try and get rid of the excitement. I love this email so much, right? You said, we're not going to report every time we find a block, but there's something special about this one, because you get an insight into how this guy must have felt in his house the moment this happened, right? Like the fingers trembling. You can imagine him scrambling, trying to look at his wallet, hands shaking. His wife wondering what the hell is going on. Why are you screaming about your weird little internet magic beans again? with these weird contraptions he's got in his garage, right? I love it. I just love it. I'd love to experience that sort of feeling. I've been in Bitcoin a long time, right? And I'm sure most people have had this experience with Bitcoin for the first few years. It's really easy to get into that bad habit of waking up every morning and checking the price, right? And then a few more years elapse, you maybe become a little more jaded, a little less interested in the dollar price. So that habit drifts away. But now I've got a bit axe gamma up. Man, I've got a new addiction now. Like every morning I wake up, my mom, my wife's there like, oh, good morning, Rick. I'm like, well, wait, hang on. I got to go and check my bit axe. Like, am I rich now? So yeah, I just love the excitement of it. And I think everybody should try it, right? Like the frequency that these solo blocks are getting found, man, it's exciting. And I think you contribute, you learn something, man, it's just a real fun time. And if you pick up a BitAxe Gamma, I mean, I haven't sat and figured out what this cost me in electricity, but I live in the UK, right? So, you know, it's a few thousand dollars just to run a light bulb. But, you know, I think this BitAxe Gamma costing me pennies a day, just to have a little bit of fun, learn something, you know, at some point try and connect that BitAxe to my own node and run my own pool. You get to dig into like all this exciting stuff you can learn about. And man, if that happens, even better, right? That's the cherry on top. So yeah, everybody should start mining. It's too much fun.
It's the wildest adventure, man. Absolutely the wildest adventure. This guy's reaction is hilarious. It reminds me of someone who just got his first kiss, right? From the girl he's had a crush on, and he's like frozen and he can't believe it. And he's like, you know, jumping all over the place, telling everyone he can find the longest path. That's the effect it has on you, you know, because it's like such a low probability of nailing it that when you do, oh my gosh, that's it, man. Like the whole universe needs to know about it. It's a great learning experience. You know, the cost is not that high. It's, you know, you start with one and then very quickly find yourself with like seven. And you wonder like why your electricity bill is so high, but you don't care, you know, because, you know, solo mining, all it takes is to hit it one time. And then all of these bills, you know, are like nothing burgers. It's a fascinating new opportunity, you know, like in a 50, 100 years, you know. People are gonna, they're gonna wonder, you know, why didn't they have this, you know, chance to be, you know, in this party that, you know, where we have this historical opportunity to still be a part of. I'm very excited about this, man. Solo mining as running a node, for me, they go hand in hand. You know, it's part of being Bitcoin. You know, like you can't be a Bitcoiner if you don't have a foot in both of these things. So congratulations on this guy. You know, I'm sure his excitement can be felt, you know, all the way up to Mars.
I think what's cool about this, besides obviously the guy winning, finding the block and, you know, just the excitement, is we have this, I think, Tony, you hit it. Like we have this really cool opportunity. Like someday, like I've only been in Bitcoin a few years now. Like I feel very late compared to someone like Rick, who's, you know, been around over a decade. But we really are still so early that someday I feel like the BitAxe, like people probably aren't going to be running BitAxes 30 years from now, right? Like, you know, we're going to move to like, maybe you mine Bitcoin when you're heating your home or whatever, like more practical applications. It's going to be fun to be able to tell the stories of the early days of Bitcoin when, you know, just like Rick, you've talked about like, the Bitcoin, what was it like the Bitcoin, faucet or whatever, you know, they dump like. That's a really cool story. Running a BitAxe and like hearing about someone else mining, finding a solo block. Like, I think all that stuff, those are just going to be stories we tell a long time from now. So everyone needs to just buck up, spend $100, $200, whatever it is, and have fun and enjoy it. It's going to be a good ride.
Well, here's the other thing. If that story about the pyramids being, you know, a power source that can provide wireless electricity globally for free, actually becomes a thing, which, you know, if you want to put on your conspiracy hat or, you know, go down some rabbit hole. I've always believed that, by the way. I've told people that story. They thought I was nuts. But somehow it's resurfaced recently. And I think there's a lot of, you know, legs to that story. And if somehow it's true and we see it, you know, unfold, holy shit, man. That is a massive game changer. Can you imagine free energy worldwide, what you can do with this? Everyone would be mining Bitcoin with like unlimited, you know, hash rate, because who cares, right? And the upgrade to humanity would be exponential, like unimaginable at this point. So I don't know. Are we at the brink of something, you know, biblical? Maybe. Or maybe I'm just like hallucinating here, but you never know. Everybody thought Bitcoin was, you know, for people on drugs and cypherpunk and criminals and all that. And look where we are now.
Absolutely. All right, we got one more. So this is an ad from 1996. It says, they say in 30 years, a burger and fries could cost $16, a vacation $12,500, and a basic car $65,000. No problem. You'll eat in, you won't drive, and you won't go anywhere. I've tried looking up where this came from. I think it's like an investment, a financial services firm. I couldn't find specifically what the ad was touting, but it's surprisingly close. Like maybe a basic car is in $65,000, and yeah, you can do a vacation for less than $12,500. But if you're driving a nice car, not even a fancy car, a nice car, going on a nice vacation with, you know, a family of four or five, like these numbers are pretty close in many cases. Certainly if you're going to Disney World, it's going to cost you this much. The funny thing is, though, I bet you in 1996, this seemed outrageous and like no one would have thought. They're like, oh, no, I know prices kind of go up. It's never going to get that crazy. Like we're here. I'll just throw it to either of you. Reaction.
I wish we were at these prices. We've blown past them. So whoever wrote this was a genius, you know, because they obviously understood the fiat Ponzi from a very early stage. Unfortunately, compared to us, which learned it, you know, at the end of its cycle. But you know, even though he predicted it, there was no way he would be able to stop it, right? There was no other alternative to the mess that we were in. But it's very interesting that these numbers played out the way they did. But again, his predictions, if we landed on his predictions, I'd be happier than where we are today.
Yeah, Rick.
Yeah. It's a crazy one, isn't it? Well, like, you know, look, I'm obviously a marketeer, right? So I know that when the guy who created that advert came up with those numbers, he was intentionally trying to make them shocking so that when you read the advert, you go, no, that's crazy. And then it grabs your interest and then they can pitch you a product, right? So that's the funny thing to me, is that this marketeer put those numbers in to intentionally shock you and be stupid and outlandish. And, you know, look, here we are. I mean, $16 for a burger is pretty good. Even, you know, like I live in Scotland. I don't think the prices are crazy in Scotland. I'll struggle to get a decent burger for $16, right? Like maybe a McDonald's, but I mean, it's barely even food, right? But if you go out for a nice burger, it's going to be more than $16. It got me interested in something though, right? Like I'm going to do something. So my wife, she used to work for a company that a lot of people have heard of, P&G, Procter & Gamble, right? They're a huge mega corp, right? And they make everything like shampoo, toothbrushes, like almost everything in the supermarkets come from about seven companies, P&G being one of them, right? But the cool thing, the interesting thing that she told me about P&G, I assume this is still true, is that they used to keep these things called Argos catalogs. You guys and the listeners might not know what I'm talking about, but an Argos catalog is like, it's like one of these big wedge books, like a phone book that used to come through your door in the UK. From a company called Argos, and you could buy everything in it, right? Like lawnmowers, kids' toys, just everything. Most people in the UK probably have a childhood memory of around Christmas time being a kid and flicking through the Argos catalog, trying to find toys that you thought were cool and this sort of thing. But what P&G apparently did is they kept, because this catalog would come out every year. They kept these catalogs every year and they have like a huge archive of them. And as soon as I heard this, I got super excited, right? Because can you imagine? I would love to go back through these catalogs and be like, how much was a bike in 1990? Because even though we talk about this all the time, I still think even we lose sight of what things used to cost back in the day. The good news is, right, I've been on eBay and I found that I can actually get my hands on some of these Argos catalogs from like 2008. Is about the time that the Bitcoin launched, right? It's going to cost me $30 to get this stupid catalog that's not worth anything. But I'll go and pick one up, right? Because it'll be quite fun for us to go back through that catalog and just look at the prices of things. The last thing I'll say on this advert, my favorite bit is at first I thought it was a World Economic Forum advert because like Tony says, the guy offers no solution, right? I can't remember. What did it say at the bottom? It just said, but don't worry because go on.
No problem. You'll eat in, you won't drive and you won't go anywhere. I thought it was a WEF ad too.
yeah. You will live in the pod. You will eat the bugs and you won't go outside, right? It's like it's crazy. And the crazy thing is there's a lot of people who can't buy cars, who can't go on holiday, who stay at home almost indefinitely because they've got no money. So, Klaus Schwab's probably pretty happy, but we're coming for you, Klaus. Like, we are going to win. You can't stop Bitcoin. It's game over, pal.
Amen. You can't stop Bitcoin. I think that's a good place to wrap up. For everyone listening, thank you for tuning in. As always, if you need help with proper 100% Bitcoin self-custody, if you even want the option to burn your Bitcoin when you die, you've got to have it in self-custody. Don't leave it at a custodian. Go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. We can help you do that the right way the first time. We also help with online privacy phones. We've got a Plan B residency option for you as well. So again, that's thebitcoinway.com/podcast. Gents, until next time, good chatting with you. And Lord knows we'll have a lot of fun stuff to cover next week.
Sounds good, man. Thank you, Michael.
Cheers, Michael.
Cheers, guys.